Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
My favorite shows on TV have 12 minutes of advertising.
I can't get behind that kind of time.
Eat quickly, drive faster, make more money now. I can't get behind that.
My kids say, he said to me, and I'm like, and he's like, and she's like,
it's all he's all, she's all.
I can't get behind that kind of, like, English.
That'll be 6 to 8 weeks before delivery.
The rising oceans, the warming temperatures.
The dying polar bears, no tigers in 50 years.
Rising poison in the air and water.
I can't understand why the price of gas suddenly rises when oil goes up.
But takes months to go down long after oil falls.
I can't get behind any of that.
I can't get behind the gods.
All right, so we're playing that song just to get you in the mood for the kind of thing that we're going to do today, which is a pretty open-ended call-in show. We have a brand new call-in number, so we want you to test it out like you did last week. Just Chuck Yeager that sucker, you know, just push the envelope. The number is 888-720-WNPR. If you're not into that whole alphanumeric thing, or at least the alpha part of it, you can go 888-720-9677. That would be straight up numeric. All right. So, and really, you know, I mean, I have things that I'm interested in talking about, but I think the rule is that, you know, if there are calls and they're about other things, then they're not things that I'm interested in talking about. We should talk about them anyway, and you can get me interested. That's going to happen with the first call. The first call today, I mean, it's already on the board. She's been waiting. I'm going to take it. But I'm going to just say straight up also that this is one of these actually pretty important news topics that, you know, it's kind of like even if you're a talk show host, you sort of pick and choose a little bit. You know, there's like certain things you just decide, well, somebody else is going to know about that one, right? So that's I've got one of those, one that I sort of basically took a pass on. I don't know squat about it, really, but I think it's a good idea to take it. Anyway, let me just tell you a little bit more about some of the things that are going to happen today. One thing I'm going to say is you shouldn't feel as though you can only bring up news topics, because one of the things that I think distinguishes this show is, in a lot of ways, we don't even make a big distinction between news and culture. To me, they're not as separated as some people make them out to be. So, I mean, and to that end, I want to say that although we just had that lovely Bill Shatner melody, we're from now on, all the songs that you'll hear today as we go out of a segment will be from the Obamas, Barack and Michelle, and I assume maybe the kids, too, got involved, summer playlist, which is a tremendous thing, a mighty thing, a real document of eclecticism. It goes from Cole Porter to Q-Tip and perhaps beyond. It intrigues me for some reasons that maybe I'll have time to talk about as we go along here. But yeah, you know, we can talk about Andrew Luck, and we can talk about the Obama summer playlist, and we can talk about, but we can also talk about things in politics and news. And I do want to point out, I was an early adopter of Elizabeth Warren, and she is surging. I mean, it really, at this moment, it is, as Politico pointed out today, it's the rock star versus the rock. It's her versus Biden right now. I mean, the field will doubtless shake in other ways, and the dice and tiles will get redistributed. But right now, Elizabeth Warren kind of holds the key to maybe unlocking Biden's grip on the nomination. So let's begin with that call about a thing which, quite frankly, I'm going to confess, I know very little. And here is Sarah, who called before the show even started. You got to reward that kind of dedication. So Sarah from West Hartford, you're on the air.
Thanks, Colin. I was a little energized to call today because I actually had an editorial printed in The Current yesterday about this issue, which is a news issue. Mm-hmm. It's also becoming a culture issue, as you were saying earlier. The crumbling foundation crisis is a problem, not just for people in eastern Connecticut, but for everybody in our state, and soon in our region, and soon, I think, nationwide. And the thing that inspired me to call today was I received an email over the weekend from someone who read my editorial, who said, you know, I'm being blamed for the $12 surcharge that everybody is being charged on our homeowners insurance. You know, it's like people who have the crumbling foundation problem are being, again, victimized in other ways. First of all, just so everyone understands, in eastern Connecticut, there was a quarry that put out large amounts of concrete, mostly used for home foundations, for about 30 years, starting in about 1983. And so thousands of homes and other structures are built with this concrete that contains too much of an element called pyrrhotite, like an iron ore, and it absorbs air and water and rusts, and it expands, and it just starts to wreak havoc on foundations and other structures built with it. And so people are discovering they own a home that they've been in for 10, 20, 30 years that now is falling apart and they can't sell it. And we're trying to find ways to help people remedy the problem. There's some state money. There's the surcharge, $12 a year on homeowners insurance policies. And I just want to say that these people are true victims. This was not a buyer beware. This wasn't they went to a used car dealer and bought a used car versus a new car, and it's their fault if it's breaking down. It's they're just complete pure victims. And the reason it's going to affect not just everybody in those towns, but everywhere else, is they're losing all of their home equity, which for most of us, if you think about it, is where a lot of our wealth is tied up. And if you can't sell a home that you thought had $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 worth of equity, you can't recoup that money. You can't use it to move somewhere else. You can't use it to take care of yourself. You can't use your equity to pass down to your children through, you know, wealth distribution, things like that. So, and then to have people on the street tell you you're the problem, that there's a $12 extra, or to say, you know, you're the victim, you need to fix it yourself and absorb the whole cost. So I want to keep the conversation going. I want everyone to be aware of what a terrible thing it is, not just for the individuals, not just for the streets, the neighborhoods, the towns these houses are in. It's also going to start affecting us if we don't sort of offer to find a better solution for everybody.
Thank you for doing such an excellent job of summarizing this thing, which, yeah, I guess up to 35,000 homes or more could be affected here in Connecticut. To your point, there's a segment of our society, I don't know how big it is, that has become extremely churlish about the notion of the common good, right? The common good is, I think, a little bit priced into the American experiment, the notion that the way that the nation thrives, well, it's like Bruce Springsteen says, nobody wins unless everybody wins. So if you have people whose houses are underwater, mortgage-wise or something like that, yeah, there'll be a ripple effect, and there might be some self-interested reason why you should care or why you should be willing to part with $12 to prop up these people in their houses. But you shouldn't even need to get to the self-interested part. We should basically say, look, we are essentially all in this together. And as you say, these people, they didn't get crumbling mortgages because they cut a corner or made crumbling foundations because they cut a corner or tried to get something cheaper, or, you know, it's nothing like that. They went in with honest intentions. It's a problem. It's a problem that also affects the insurance industry, which really just a problem of this magnitude. The insurance industry itself is not equipped all by itself to handle that problem. So yeah, we're all.
I don't know about that. Well, I don't know about that. There's some estimates where it's not nearly what it was for, say, Hurricane Sandy, and I don't think the insurance companies suffered too much through that.
So. Well, okay, so maybe that's subject to debate. But anyway,
right.
We're all in this together. And $12 isn't going to kill anybody. So I'm with you on this one, Sarah. And great call. Great explanation. There's a World of Warcraft call up here. I'm not going to go to it first, though, because like all of these calls are interesting. I don't know which one to go to first. Let's start with Bill in Lebanon. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi there. I joined you in the slog to the New York Times article yesterday about Neil Young.
Yeah.
That was a very long read.
And so just to summarize for people who didn't read it, so Neil Young, who's in his 70s now, I forget, 73 maybe, something like that, he's kind of become, I mean, he was, even as a young man, he sort of had a get off my lawn, crabby old man quality to him. But now he's like the ultimate grumpy old man. And one of the things that he's the most passionate about, and this goes back at least to CDs, if not even further, is the digitizing of music, which he feels is basically sucking the lightning out of music, that music is something that's sort of captured in the warmest, most organic way, that's the closest to its live analog that you can get. And when you digitize it, it's bad. It sucks the life out of the music. And he's super, super angry about it and is involved in all these curatorial efforts to at least make sure all of his stuff is preserved exactly the way that he thinks it should be preserved. And I just, you know, I found it hard. I don't know, as I guess you saw the social media thing. I started listening to Neil Young on Tidal, which is a streaming service, on my phone through, you know, a Bluetooth speaker, an Anchor Bluetooth speaker, nothing all that great, just to be a jerk and, you know, abstractly piss off Neil Young. But actually, I just, you know, he's probably right in some way, Bill. But I, you know, the what we've traded out is the incredible convenience. You know, it's so great to have a lot of music. I can take all 44 songs or whatever they are on the Obama playlist, and I can, you know, get them all organized on my phone, and I can listen to all this music that would be very hard for me to access in the way that Neil Young likes.
Sure. Well, if you really want to experience what he has out there in very high quality, you should visit the Neil Young Archives.
Yes.
If you have a high-speed internet connection at home, it costs, I think it's like $1.99 a month. I think I pay for a yearly subscription that's around $20. They stream in the highest rate you can ever imagine. It sounds like nothing else coming out of my little computer speakers. I can't compare Spotify to it, iTunes, anything else. So he is definitely doing something right.
Yeah.
The sounds that come out, the highs are higher, the lows are lower. I mean, but he's got it locked down really well. It cost him about $1 million to create, and you can't even stream it through my, you know, a high-end stereo. You have to buy a DAC connection between your computer and your stereo system, and it's very complicated. I don't even go that far. The stuff he has on his site is amazing quality.
I will say this, okay. I am frequently in the presence of real music connoisseurs. Probably the most severe of them is Steve Metcalf, who, first of all, has unbelievable ears. He has perfect pitch. He has an incredible command of as wide a range of music as anybody I can think of. And I think he would say, you know, that there might be some, you know, audiophilic truth to some of the stuff that Neil Young is saying, but that it's worth it to have, like, he thinks the greatest invention in music in the last 25 years is the shuffle feature, where basically, you know, you can create an opportunity to hear, you know, 30 different artists in a row. I mean, right. That kind of stuff. It's a little bit incompatible with what Neil wants to do, but, you know, probably when robots take over, they'll just make us listen to them. You know, we should enjoy it now when we don't have to listen to the music that our robot overlords think is really good. Because, you know, our robot overlords, their music is going to suck, right? And we're not going to have any choice about it either. All right, where does Betsy Kaplan want me to go next? She wants me to go to Aaron in Madison. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going?
Are you the Yankees guy from last week?
No, man. I'm a Red Sox fan.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about Andrew Luck. I really think this might be changing the trend in football. I think with he retiring so early, I think these younger, smarter kids are going to take their $75 million and say, hey, I don't want my head bashed in anymore. I'm out of here.
I mean, to me, Aaron, the surprise is not that Andrew Luck is doing this. The surprise is that more people don't do it, you know, because as you point out, I don't know, Mike Pesca tried to really crunch the numbers and figure out how much money after he pays out agent fees and everything else Andrew Luck really has. He came up with $40 million, and Pesca's really good with numbers. So let's say that's right. So, and yeah. He wants to travel the world, and he just got married, and he can stay in the nicest hotel in Singapore. And, you know, I mean, like, who would stay out there and risk further damage? You know, he's had the excitement of being a first of the first. He was the first pick of the first round. He's had the excitement of being a Pro Bowl player. He's, you know, he's played in the NFL.
Let's not forget, Colin, he has a degree from Stanford University. I feel like companies kind of like that.
Right. Well, yeah, no new companies kind of like that, but, you know, not to in any way cast asparagus on any other institutions of learning. But, you know, he might have come out of Stanford with a wider range of interests, you know, interests that cannot be satisfied on the football field, interests that require him, you know, to visit cathedrals or art museums or whatever. And I don't know what he majored in. But I think it's a healthy thing. I don't think there's any reason that you have to play as long as Tom Brady is right. playing, but that's what Tom Brady wants to do, so good on him. Yeah, you know, that whoever that guy is, there's this guy who's got some dinky little sports thing who said that Luck was a millennial and, you know, he just was taking this soft choice, which he entirely did to increase his own visibility, and he got his wish. Doug Gottlieb, I think, is his name. But Troy Aikman just ripped into him on Twitter today. So, and Troy's got the concussions to have a certain amount of bona fides about this, right?
No, and believe me, I just think that I hope there's a huge ripple in the minds of the up and coming college kids that say, you know what, I'm going to work my tail off, but I'm only going to get in there for the years that I'm going to get the money. And then I hope we look back at this 5 years from now and say, it was Andrew Luck.
I would agree. You know, if people did, there was a 49ers linebacker who got out pretty fast a few years ago. But, you know, 5 years and out and you're okay and you're not having all kinds of symptoms, makes sense to me. All right. So 860-275-72. No, it's not. Never mind that number. That was habit. 888-720-WNPR. 888-720-9677. We got a bunch of calls on the board. I just want to add one more thing, because I think this is maybe a thing that Aaron was getting at, and maybe I didn't let him get it all the way out, which is that Andrew Luck could save football in the sense that football, if you played it for 4 or 5 years and that became closer to the norm, could be this thing that didn't result in so many Mike Webster-type tragedies, you know, horrible casualties, guys who wind up with such terrible brain damage that they take their own lives and stuff like that, that if you could make football into something that we wouldn't have to be quite as ashamed of liking, which describes my current set of mind. All right, so now I'm told I'm going to Eric. All right. This is one I'm going to have a lot of trouble helping out with, Eric, but that's some of the beauty of this show. All right. You've got the floor, Eric.
All right. So today marks the release of WoW Classic, or World of Warcraft Classic. It's been 15 years since World of Warcraft released. It's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. Over the years, there have been many iterations of the game that have made changes to the characters, the land.
Oh, some, you know, orcs or something are jamming your transmission right now. If you're on like a cordless phone and you want to get closer to the base unit or something, I think you made your point. World of Warcraft, 15 years old. Why ever leave the house, etc. All right, here we are. We're going to move to Ed and Ramesh. And Ramesh, don't hang up, because I will get to you, and I want to talk to you about this. So Ed from Rocky Hill, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Colin, how's it going?
Okay.
So I'm 67 years old. I had a knee replaced a year ago. I haven't been to a loud rock show in a rock club in probably 5 years because of all the nuisance that you can imagine, the loud noise, the crowds, the standing for hours waiting. And I went to a club this weekend and saw two bands, and I remembered the joy of what rock and roll can do for you. And so I just wanted to share that with people, that especially people my age, that maybe if you've forgotten that, or you only go to shows in big arenas, there is this thing about being in a club, listening to great music.
So really quickly, what was the club and what were the bands?
So it was a space in Hamden, and I went to see Mark Mulcahy, who I consider a genius. He's he lives in Springfield, but he's known across the world for his music. And the thing that really did it for me was the opening band was a band called Split Coils, and the guy got up on stage and he said, "Well, I'm an appliance repairman from Shelton, but this is what I do." And he played a magnificent set of music. It was just wonderful.
All right, Ed, that's a great call, and don't worry about your hearing. I've been to multiple Dropkick Murphys concerts, and actually I have damaged my hearing by doing that. Like I said, I don't really have an affirming thing to say. Hi, Ramesh, I know you have to go, so I want to get to you real fast.
Okay. Thanks, Colin. Enjoy your show. But basically, I was listening to your show on Friday and also read your New Haven Register piece about this boycott of Pepe's. Well, you know, I live in New Haven, and pizza is not some commonplace food, some commonplace dish that we're talking about. We're talking about something much more major. And for the international global pizza community, you know, for a spokesman like Pepe's to go and make something, a public stand, take a public stand, is like New York Times saying, I'm going to support only the Republicans, or something like that, you know. And that's why a stand like that is way too public and should not be taken by the spokesperson of the global pizza community.
All right. I love the global pizza community anyway, and so I'm going to let you go because I know you had to leave anyway. Let me just say a little bit more about this, because we did talk about it on Friday. So if for the people who are just are clueless here, Gary Bamante, who's one of the many grandchildren of Frank Pepe, we said Pepe the wrong way all the way through Friday's show, too. We certainly heard about that. Frank Pepe's grandchildren now own and run the famous pizzeria on Worcester Street, but also the various franchises of it as well. And so there's a lot of owners, 7, 8, 9 owners probably. But the most public one, the kind of public-facing one, is a guy named Gary Bamante. He is a Trump supporter. There is even a photograph of him proudly holding up a deplorables for Trump sign. And this has occasioned some discussion on social media of boycotting Pepe's. And look, I think everybody has to make their own decision about all this stuff. It can get a little silly and a little crazy. I'll give you the craziest example. All right. So during the Roy Moore controversy, Sean Hannity said some stuff on his show, which was so offensive or so dismissive of the claims made by the young women or the formerly young women that Keurig pulled out as an advertiser, which caused right-wing Sean Hannity fans on Reddit and other places to organize these Keurig boycotts, and they were burning their Keurig machines or wrecking them or whatever, and they were never going to use Keurig coffee again. And they even were saying, so let's stick it to the libs. We're not going to drink Keurig coffee anymore because they didn't take Sean Hannity's side in this. And, of course, I don't know, as somebody who tracks liberal, cares about the environment. I hate Keurig because they make all this crappy, unnecessary plastic waste. So I don't mind if you boycott it. And should I mind if you boycott it for the wrong reason, that you're boycotting it because you're a Sean Hannity fan? I don't know. I don't really care. But I think here's the part of what I believe about this, which is, boycotting is mostly a cheap date with your conscience, right? There's almost no effort involved in it. There's a lot of effort involved in going to a march or organizing a rally or parting with your own money to make a donation somewhere or being a volunteer for something or pestering your state representatives or members of Congress about something that's important to you. These are all affirmative things that you have to do that take energy. Walking across Worcester Street to eat at a different pizza place, to me, doesn't really rank up there with those things. I mean, I get it. It's your money. You don't want to give it to somebody that you don't like or somebody whose views really make you sick. I get all that. And by all means, knock yourself out. But I just don't really think that, that you're accomplishing as much as you think you're accomplishing. And if you use that kind of thing, boycotting, as a substitute for real substantive kinds of actions and gestures, I think you're kidding yourself. I think there's a lot of virtue signaling that goes on with all this stuff, too. So I don't really care whether you eat at Pepe's or not. I probably won't eat at Pepe's just because it's a big nuisance. And there's these Albanian guys across the street. I want to try their pizza. And I usually go to Modern anyway because there's no line or anything. But do whatever you want to do. But don't tell yourself that you're really accomplishing much by the boycotts. It takes more than that. And the other thing I would say is you could probably also accomplish a little bit more. I tried to make this point on Friday by picking some small local business that is on the right side of an issue. Or I've been sort of touting this El Paso restaurant in Plainville where the husband and owner was deported by ICE you know, make an effort to eat in a place like that to show your sympathies if you have sympathies. Anyway, that's all. That's the whole boycott spiel. All right, we got lots of time left, and so I'm going to give out the number again. 888-720-WNPR. You may call up about any topic. I will throw out some topics, too, if there's a need. That's 888-720-9677. Let's take a quick break. We'll hear a little thing from the Obama playlist, and we'll come back. Late again, he may not come when you want, but I'm always up on time, so roll up and smoke, la la. The weed too potent, so I had to call mama, tell her how much I love her for cooking them home products. When them bills were pile up, cereal with the water. If Lord couldn't help us, we had hamburger helper. When you want it done right, you gotta get it for yourself, huh? It don't seem right being older than my uncle. Some people call it ghetto, I prefer another level, but I'm about to board this plane. I can't wait to see your face and hear you say, come on in, close the door, and feel the vibe. We got macaroni and cheese, collard greens, and chicken inside. We are back. Yeah, we're going to take some phone calls here at 888-720-WNPR. Let's get some more women to call. Our first caller was Sarah, a woman, and I don't think we've had a woman since then. So feel free, feel empowered to make your voice heard, women. 888-720-9677. And yeah, all topics are a fair game. I mean, it's sort of amazing. I think, have we gotten through the entire first 30 minutes without saying the name of a certain occupant of the White House? I think we have, which is impressive because he occupies so much of our brain space. I thought surely somebody would take us in that direction. Okay. So here we go. I think we have an Andrew Yang caller, but we'll go to Ray first because he's been waiting longer. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hey, Colin. How you doing?
Good.
You're into Frederick Law Olmsted, right?
Yes, I am. I mean, you know, I mean, as a Hartford proud, the 860, yeah, as Frederick used to say.
Yeah. I'm reading a book by Tony Horowitz.
Poor Tony Horowitz.
I know. And it's called Spying on the South.
It was his last book before he died.
Yeah. And it's very interesting. You should pick it up and maybe do a show on it.
Yeah, I think we should, actually. This is about, Olmsted was involved in spying on the Confederacy in some way, right?
Yeah.
He
traveled with his brother, John, I believe, a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was sending dispatches back to the New York Times. And he took two trips.
All right. You've persuaded me. We should look into this. Obviously, we can't have Tony Horowitz on. Poor guy died not too long ago, died on the young side. But there's a lot of Frederick Law Olmsted scholars out there. There's got to be people that Tony talked to that we could have on as guests. All right, here's James in Old Saybrook. We got lots of open lines right now, which is a rare thing on these shows. So let me give out the phone number one more time. 888-720-WNPR. 888-720-9677. If you don't like to do letters on your phone thing. Hi, James. You got the floor.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick your thoughts about universal basic income. As someone who just this morning saw something on Reddit about it, just the pros and cons from your point of view, and Donald Trump's a clown.
Okay. Oh, you wanted to break the sound barrier there on Trump. So this is sort of, are you specifically referring to the Andrew Yang idea or the old, there's a version of this has gone back. It goes all the way back to, of all things, the Nixon administration. So I don't know which one, like, you know, Yang has sort of basically a kind of a trickle-out idea. Is that the one that you're reacting to?
Yes, that's the one I saw today.
Okay. So Andrew Yang's idea basically is, yeah, you give everybody, what is it, $12,000 a year or something like that. And the idea also being that that's actually money that works in the economy. People who need this, who get this, will spend it. They'll spend it. They'll stimulate the economy. It'll relieve some of the economic pressure that they feel. And it'll get money out there. And he has discussions. I mean, he has ideas about how he would pay for this, too, because obviously it's a lot of money. But he thinks ultimately the bullet effect in the economy would ultimately pay for it anyway, just by creating economic activity, particularly in times when there's stagnation. As we begin to creep what towards what looks like a recession. You know, I mean, a recession is essentially a slowdown or cessation of certain economic activities. So the notion of more money out there is maybe even a little bit more intriguing. So I don't know. What intrigues you about it? Or are you pro? Or are you con? Give me your thoughts.
I'm leaning pro. Mm-hmm. I had a thought that, you know, and I saw some of the comments that people were like, well, it'll cause people to, you know, slack off, not try to find work. But for someone who's lower class to middle class, that it wouldn't do that to me. It would just make life easier.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't have to stress and stay awake crunching the numbers trying to figure out how I'm going to pay for my mortgage.
Right. I first of all, nobody's going to not work because they've got $12,000. That's not enough reason to not work. So, you know, I mean, just to go back. So believe it or not, Dick Nixon, who was a pretty conservative guy, did float the idea at one point of a minimum income. So it's actually considerably more radical than what Yang was talking about, but that there would actually be a floor below which no American would fall. You know, there you could maybe have a conversation about disincentive to work, although I think labor incentives could be priced into almost anything like that. But in the case of Yang's thing, I don't think that's what he's talking about anyway. He's just talking about spending less money on certain things. I mean, look, our military budget is so freaking huge. I mean, it'd be easy enough to peel off the money that you would need to start this. But I think he also just sees it as a way to make the economy work when sometimes it doesn't. I don't think it's going to, you know, first of all, it's not going to happen. So we're having a purely academic conversation. But the fact that we have conversations like this means, James, that maybe somewhere down the road it gets more real.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. Boy, you have to be ready for anything around here. Here's Paul calling in. We do need some women to call up. I'm feeling too Y chromosome here right now. 888-720-WNPR. 888-720-9677. All right, Paul, you have the floor.
Yeah. Hi. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. So, listen, I've been trying to call the show and trying to talk to as many people as I can about this. As somebody who stumbled across opiate dependence through prescription due to a health reason, I was prescribed opiates, and I had to find a way to get off of them. And there's this drug called buprenorphine.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is with this medication is not that it's not effective. It's great at helping. It's like the new methadone. It helps people get off opiates. The problem is in the state of Connecticut and the federal government restricts who and how many patients this can be prescribed to by doctors. So say I'm Dr. A and I'm prescribing opiates. I can prescribe as many prescriptions as I want till the DEA shuts me off. But you have to have a prescription. You can only have, like, say, 30 patients in your first year of prescribing buprenorphine, and then it goes up and up and up. But there's no reason why any doctor should not be allowed to prescribe buprenorphine to help people in this crisis. I mean, all over the country, we have people dying every day, massive amounts, and there should not be any regulation on helping people get off opiates.
Right. I mean, first of all, I don't know enough about this to have a really well-informed opinion. I mean, my guess is that, I mean, first of all, I believe at both the federal and state level, there is some monitoring about, you know, who's prescribing a lot. There's ways to know this, both with opioids and with this new drug that's a possible remedy to the addiction. It could be that this is something that needs to be thrashed out. Unfortunately, at the level of state legislation, either that or state regulation through the governor's office. And it probably is the case that the drug is so new and so poorly understood that people are dragging their feet and kind of slow walking this a little bit. But if it's really as good as you say it is, my guess is that first of all, you'll get the government action that you're looking for. And also things that work. Okay, go ahead. Sure.
It's not a magic bullet. It's not a magic bullet. It has been around for a number of years, and I'd like to think that's a good excuse for the government to be dragging their feet by saying this is a possibly dangerous medication, but I wish that was the truth, Colin. It's not. This medication has been proven to be safe. It's been proven to save lives. It's a hell of a lot. It's been around for a while, so it's got a proven track record. It's not about saving. It's about helping, you know, protecting the public. It's more of this. I mean, we just saw this huge pharmaceutical price fixing scam. We've seen, you know, these million dollar. I mean, these buildings at museums being names being taken down. I mean, this is some serious corruption.
Right.
I
mean,
I don't think that this is past the point of corruption, is not letting doctors prescribe buprenorphine to where they're allowed.
I'd want to know a little bit more about that issue, and I apologize for not being able to talk intelligibly about it right now. But we certainly do, as you're saying, we know how the opioids got onto the market. We know the mechanisms by which they became overprescribed. We know that just out and out lies were told about the risks associated with these drugs. So hopefully we can reverse all that, because we now have just a full-blown crisis. It could be argued we've had a full-blown crisis for a really long time, and maybe it's just starting to get noticed. All right, let me squeeze Cyril in here, and then we're going to go take a break. Hi, Cyril. You're on the air from New Haven. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm a nurse. I work at Yale, and I always wonder about healthcare in the United States. And, like, I'm a math guy, so I did a little bit of math. So $3.6 trillion, that's about what we pay for healthcare in the United States. There's about 156 million working-age Americans that are in the workforce, and I just wonder why each of us couldn't pay $1,000 a year, and that would more than cover all the healthcare costs incurred by all Americans.
Well, I mean, first of all, email your numbers to Elizabeth Warren immediately. I mean, I do feel as though... Okay, I have to sort of backtrack and say, you know, when Obamacare happened, obviously it was a radical change, and you couldn't help but applaud it because at least we were doing something. But those of us who'd really looked at healthcare for a really long time, and I mean, I started to be interested in healthcare reform back in the 90s. It's always seemed like either single payer or public option; those are the ways to go. And I was disappointed. I mean, Obama was a very interesting person, and he was a very effective president in a lot of ways. But he wasn't a guy who he went with what was possible rather than pursuing radical change. So what we have is the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, doesn't work as well as radical health reform should work. And I mean, I think Cyril's points are pretty good. I would recommend American Sickness by Elizabeth Rosenthal. I think it's the best book that's ever been written about the problem. The real problem is we have this patchwork, nonsensical system in which you can't even really identify a specific villain. You know, there's a system that doesn't work. It doesn't extend our lifespans. It doesn't make us address medical problems effectively. It doesn't make us cause us to make the best choices about how to deal with medical issues. But it's hard to point to who is doing that. Like, it would be easy to say, oh, well, it's the insurance companies. But in fact, the insurance companies, in many cases, wind up spending way more than they have to because the system doesn't make any sense. It's not set up to make any sense or to result in good choices. So, you know, I mean, it just seems to me that a public option is probably the easier thing to get through. But I'm thrilled to see a Democratic primary season, a debate season, in which something closer to single payer, or I guess Medicare for All is what we're calling it these days, is at least being contemplated and discussed. It might be an easier thing to get through than anybody imagines. All right, so let's grab a break here. We'll come back with our final segment.
Not to be outdone, President Trump has released his summer playlist. It's Don Rickles' Hello Dummy on a continuous loop. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Q-Tip. On tomorrow's show, our salute to Barbie. And now, back to Colin.
Okay, we're going to go to Carol and Nancy and Ev and anybody else we can squeeze in here at 888-720-WNPR. That's 888-720-9677. I did want to say one serious thing about the Obama summer playlist. So the Obamas, they put out this playlist. It is 44 songs, the oldest of which is probably I've Got You Under My Skin or... what's the Ella tune that he's got? He's got How High the Moon, I think, is the Ella tune that's on that list. But and then there's like the hip hop tune we played out of the first segment with is like was on nobody's radar. It's by an act called BJ the Chicago Kid and featuring Anderson .Paak called Feel the Vibe. And there's all kinds of stuff in there. And there's a couple of kind of unimaginative choices. Obama kind of went chalk with his Van Morrison choice and his Steely Dan choice. But we also know from his NCAA picks that he likes to go chalk. So, but I think there's an argument being made by this list. There's two things that I wanted to say about it. One of them is, if you look at this list, it is an incredibly diverse list. All kinds of artists, all kinds of colors of artists. There's this idea, really, that culture unites us and excites us together as opposed to carving us up into little fiefdoms. And that's very much the way they seem to roll with their musical tastes and maybe other stuff as well. The other thing is, you know, and not to make an obvious invidious comparison, but when the Obamas were in the White House, they were maybe the most culturally interesting people ever to inhabit the White House. And that includes, you know, the Kennedys and the Clintons. But I don't know. I discovered Esperanza Spalding watching her play Stevie Wonder's Overjoyed at some White House event. I mean, these are people who they read books. They read novels. They watched movies. They got hooked on things like Game of Thrones. They had very avid musical tastes. You know, they were really interested in the culture that they inhabit. And culture isn't a condiment and it's not dessert. It is part of the main meal of any civilization's life. And suggesting that it isn't is a kind of impoverishment that will probably throw off your judgment, too. And yes, it is a stark contrast to, I mean, the Obamas had pets, too. It is a stark contrast to the current occupant of the White House, who, to the best of my knowledge, has no cultural passions whatsoever. I'm not aware of any music that he particularly likes. I'm not aware of any book or novel or anything like that he's read in the last 20 years, a movie that he's seen. I mean, he seems to be interested in almost nothing except golf and the P word and cheeseburgers, you know, and he doesn't have any pets. He's never had a pet in his life. That should alarm us. People's personal habits and how they play out, even in their cultural consumption, tell you a lot about them. Anyway, I'll stop. Anyway, it's time for Carol and then Nancy. We got a whole bunch of callers now, but Carol, go ahead. You've got the floor.
Hi, Colin. How are you?
Good.
Good. You said that you were missed having somebody say something about Trump, so I'll tell you two quick things. One, we were in St. Petersburg, Russia, a few weeks ago, and I was chatting with some college students, and we were chatting, and I said, by the way, can I send you Trump? And she said, no, thank you. We have Putin. So that was my laugh of the afternoon. And secondly, I don't think one of my ex-friends said, I don't have to like the man to appreciate the things he's done. And I said, I cannot think of one thing that he has done that has not been mean, racist, or stupid. And I said, Mussolini made the trains run on time, and that doesn't mean I'm supposed to like him.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Trump comment. You
All
can
right.
tell how I feel rather
mm-hmm.
vehemently. My second pet peeve is sports and colleges. All the hoopla about kids getting into colleges by them lying about sports, et cetera, et cetera. It's still being done semi-legitimately because I think sports and colleges, sports should be an extracurricular activity, not the main reason why someone gets into college when his SAT scores and his high school performance do not match the school. I tutored a kid who was the lacrosse captain of his high school team, and he got into Yale with scores that would not have gotten him into UConn. And I said to him, how will you survive in Yale? And he said, they told me they would get me tutors. If colleges did away with the emphasis on sports and considered it no more than being in the orchestra or, you know, any other activity, then we wouldn't have this total ridiculousness of kids getting into colleges where they do not belong.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for your call. I have a lot I could say about that, but that would eat into the time of Nancy and other callers, so I'll hold my fire on that. Here's Nancy calling from Bloomfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling about climate, mm-hmm. which I guess nobody has brought up yet so far. So I don't want to go into all the information that's available to people, but I did want to bring to your attention and everyone's attention that there is a week of climate action coming up in September. It's a global week of action. It's been called by the youth climate movement, student strike movement in Europe primarily.
20th to the 27th.
Yep. And the kickoff is the 20th, which is a Friday, the global day of action for the climate. And in Hartford, we're busy planning something for the state capitol at noon, student-led, but we're getting as many groups and people as possible to show up at the capitol at noon. And there'll be speakers, but there'll also be action, and there'll be community building, et cetera. So people who are feeling overwhelmed maybe by all the information that's coming out lately about climate and about the inaction that we're seeing, this is to rally people together to present a list of demands to the governor for the upcoming legislative session, et cetera.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, it's somewhat in the spirit of the post-Parkland student activism on guns. You know, it is young people saying, look, we've been waiting for you guys to do something about it. You're not doing anything about it. We're going to hold your feet to the fire. And I think that a lot of the rhetoric that they're using is very appropriate. There's some kind of singing thing, right? Isn't there a song everybody's supposed to sing? Just Do It or something like that?
Maybe. We haven't really talked about that in our planning meeting.
I think we are
trying to center student voices and get everybody there to, you know, maybe the kids will walk out of class, get out of class, whatever, people will leave work, et cetera, on a Friday for the plant.
Well, it doesn't always work, but it helps. It certainly was a feature of the Vietnam protests back in the day. So, yeah. Okay. So who is Betsy Kaplan telling me that I should take? All right. Oh, we're going to go. We're going to stay with the all woman theme of this. Oh, no, that's going to be a little bit too technical. Mary Jo, if you would call back about that next week, I can tell right now that the time that would take is not great. Let's go to Bob in Southington. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Long time listener. I'm jogging right now. Sometimes bad things have good results. My wife, I taught social studies for a year. My wife hated politics. She went to vote because, you know, she wanted to keep peace in the family. Now, with our current president, she watches all the news programs, the world news.
Right. Oh, I think you just got...
It actually had a positive effect.
All right. Did you say you were jogging right now? Did you see you were jogging?
Yeah.
All right. So go back to jogging. I'm worried about you trying to talk and jog at the same time. It also allows me to. I mean, a lot of people are having the reverse of that, which is kind of a Trump exhaustion, a way in which the news is more than they can consume. I'm actually hearing from colleagues of mine who are journalists who never imagined that they would go on any kind of news diet, but they're finding that their nerves and their brain space and everything else is just being eroded by the current climate. And so they're shutting down, or at least cutting back on their own news consumption. And these are people who were career journalists. Okay, so since he was jogging, I had one thing I wanted to say, which is that, and I have just enough time to say it. So I wear one of these fitness trackers, and I've become kind of obsessed with getting to the 10,000-step American Heart Association goal every day. And I've got this dog visiting our house who likes to go for walks, so we've sort of teamed up to try to get to that 10,000. Or we actually have teamed up to try to walk 5 miles a day, which is a little bit more than 10,000 steps. And anyway, over the weekend, in a New York Times Magazine piece by Kim Tingley, I learned that the 10,000-step goal most likely comes from the word for pedometers sold in Japan since the 1960s, Manpo Kei, which translates to 10,000 steps meter, a number apparently chosen in part because the Japanese character for it looks like a walking man. So rather than this 10,000 steps being the result of careful clinical analysis about what the most beneficial level would be for your cardiovascular system, it's actually I mean, if Kim's right about this anyway, it's actually sort of a vast misunderstanding that is based somewhat anyway on kind of a calligraphic similarity between a word and the figure of a man. And in that article, it's in the Sunday Times Magazine that came out yesterday, she also says, like in the limited amount of clinical analysis they've done of this, you probably are better off with 7,500 steps and then some strength training to go with it, which also makes sense. So that doesn't mean that guy shouldn't keep jogging. He can keep jogging all he wants. But just be aware, the 10,000 step thing, to which I have dedicated huge swatches of my summer, may be nonsense. All right, thanks for calling in today. And I don't know, we may keep doing this. It's kind of fun. It gets the adrenaline going.